Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
Among the more exhausted playoff teams in the NHL are the Dallas Stars and the Anaheim Mighty Ducks. Of the two, the Ducks are no doubt the less exhausted since Anaheim won the extraordinary 5-overtime game in Dallas with which the Stars-Ducks second-round playoff series began Thursday night and continued into Friday morning. The marathon was only the most recent dramatic pearl in what is becoming a remarkable run for the team with perhaps the silliest name in professional sports. From KKJZ in Long Beach, California, Nick Roman has this report.
The stands are packed and the fans are loud. You can tell it's hockey playoff time in Southern California. But this isn't the Mighty Ducks and the Dallas Stars. It's a playoff game between the 6 to 8-year-old kids who skate with the Scorpions and the Rattlesnakes. They play at the Laguna Hills Roller Hockey Complex, about 15 miles from the Arrowhead Pond, where the Mighty Ducks play.
We have quite a few kids that enjoy the game of hockey.
Well, of course. I mean, this is hockey country, right?
You better believe it, without a doubt.
It's no wonder Robin Gore is convinced. She has to organize games for 38 teams that play at this rink, from adults to preschoolers, the little ducklings, she calls them. Robin's own son skates on 4 teams.
Well, if he's not playing hockey, he's watching it, or he's playing it on TV, or he's reading about it, or writing about it and drawing pictures.
Writing about it?
Yeah, he writes stories about when he grows up and is in the NHL, and he's going to be like J.S. Aguirre, who's the goalie for the Ducks and is phenomenal.
Sure sounds like hockey passion, like the sound inside the Arrowhead Pond when the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim finished off the once mighty Red Wings of Detroit.
Joseph makes the save, can't cover it up. From behind the goal, Freddy Ferrucci, it's good!
Adrian Stonehouse has heard that kind of cheering before. He skates and referees at the roller rink in Laguna Hills, but he grew up in Montreal, where hockey and the Canadiens are loved unconditionally by every fan.
They like the home team to win, but if it's a good game, they're happy. In California, if the home team's losing, they don't want anything to do with them.
It's Vince Lombardi with a twist. Winning isn't everything, but it's the only thing Southern California fans will pay to see. Even in March, with a playoff trip guaranteed, the Mighty Ducks were stuck with close to 8,000 unsold tickets for back-to-back games against Chicago and San Jose. There were only 7 Ducks sellouts all season. Debbie Herbert did her part. She organizes trips to Ducks games, 40 and 50 fans at a time. She says a guy she dated as a teenager in Connecticut rooted for the Rangers and the Islanders.
And we would go into the games. He's the one who got me hooked on hockey.
He was a boyfriend.
A high school boyfriend who was a hockey player plus a big fan, so we'd go in to see the games.
The boyfriend's long gone, but
the hockey stayed.
And now Debbie, who left Connecticut years ago, says her son Chris spends more time at the roller rink than at home, either skating with one of the adult teams or reffing the little kids' games, or plotting the lineup for the Ducks' first shift against Dallas.
All right, I'd send out Paul Kariya left wing, Adam Oates, Peter Sikora, and Ozolinch.
All right, you should know that a Southern California kid knowing even 2 players on a pro hockey team is amazing to those of us who grew up here. 40 years ago, the only team in town was the L.A. Blades, a minor league club whose best-known player was Willie O'Ree, the NHL's first black player, who later spent 6 years in Los Angeles. So, from a minor league team with only 1 named player to 2 NHL franchises, one of which just swept the Stanley Cup champions. And now, even Canadiens loyalist Adrian Stonehouse admits the call of the Mighty Ducks is getting to him.
My family's a big Duck fan, true and green.
True and green.
Green and purple and whatever, you know, teal, whatever color they are.
Okay, so it doesn't roll off the tongue like the Montreal Canadiens' Bleu Blanc Rouge. But teal is quite attractive in the springtime, in the playoffs. For Only a Game, I'm Nick Roman in Laguna Hills, California.
The strongest union in sports, the Major League Baseball Players Association, may not be representing a considerable number of its members as regards the issue of drug testing. That's one conclusion Buster Olney and Mike Freeman reached in a New York Times article this week. The union balks at drug testing, but some union members feel that testing for steroids is the only way to catch cheaters and protect the health and the jobs of players who are clean. Buster Olney of the New York Times joins me now on the phone from his home in New York. Welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Buster, who are the players who want a serious steroid testing policy, and why do they think it's necessary at this point?
Well, last summer, USA Today did a poll of players. I think they had 556 out of, say, 750 players answered at least one question, and 79% of the players indicated that they wanted a strong drug testing program. And ultimately, the union did negotiate a drug testing program with the owners, but a lot of people feel that it's somewhat toothless, including players within the union. And this spring, Chicago White Sox, a number of players on their team, and at least one National League team, attempted to boycott the testing because they didn't feel it was strong enough.
And the idea in boycotting the testing is if I don't agree to be tested, I'll be counted as a positive, and that will step up the whole process.
Right. It'll skew the statistical results. It'll force mandatory drug testing for next year, which is what a lot of the players want.
What happens under the current policy if a player gets caught?
Theoretically, a player could stand in the middle of a clubhouse and, in full view of the administrators of this program, to jab himself with some steroids and then do it again the following week and then do it again the next year and then do it again before he actually would face any sanctions.
And is the concern that the players who don't like this system that there's a health risk that Major League Baseball isn't recognizing and that the union isn't recognizing, or that it's cheating and guys who are staying clean just can't hit the ball as far?
Yeah, in the same USA Today poll, 44% of the players indicated they felt pressure to use some sort of a supplement, a performing-enhancing substance, because of other players they suspect are using it as well. And to maintain a competitive balance, you know, to maintain their own careers, they feel that there's pressure to take this kind of stuff. And, I mean, it's been fairly well established that a lot of the substances that they're taking, from steroids to ephedra, amphetamines, that type of thing, can certainly put them at risk.
It strikes me that one of the more interesting things about this whole story, the specific substances notwithstanding, is that it is dividing the strongest union in pro sports. Can the players and their union come to some sort of united position on testing?
It's an interesting dynamic because a lot of the players don't want to really get involved. If you give them a poll and ask them privately what they think, you know, they say they want this stuff out of the game. But it's another thing to stand up in a room of your brethren and say, I want this stuff out of the game, knowing that, you know, maybe your best friend on the team, the guy in the locker next to you, may be taking this stuff. It's a little bit like that syndrome where in a college class, no one wants to raise their hand. And it's going to take, maybe it'll take the death of a player to really change that culture. And what's so odd about it is, again, this union is so strong that they can change the culture anytime they want.
Buster, numbers of players after they've retired, Jose Canseco among the prominent, have said steroids are very prevalent in Major League Baseball. Then lots of players still playing say that's a lot of baloney. Do you have any sense through your research of how prevalent steroids really are at this point?
Well, there's no real way to establish conclusively what percentage of players are, but I know I covered Major League Baseball for 10 years, and being around the players and seeing bodies change, if I were to guess myself, I would put it in the range of about 25% in terms of steroids, and I think the number is almost off the charts in terms of amphetamines, because that was just a regular part of the culture. It seemed that players felt that they needed to take something that would give them a lift before the game, you know, the super dose of caffeine, so to speak.
Well, Tony Gwynn recently agreed with you. He said amphetamine use was essentially epidemic in Major League Baseball. Should baseball be testing for amphetamines as well?
Well, there was certainly the position of a lot of team doctors at the winter meetings in Nashville in December. At that time, the doctors and trainers were briefed on the terms of the new drug testing policy, and one of the doctors asked Gene Orza, who's the general counsel for the union, why amphetamines was not on the list, and Orza's response was, and I'm paraphrasing here, we know we have this problem, and you don't want to go into it because it's so wide. You know, Tony used the word rampant. Another player I talked to estimated 75% of the players are using this stuff. As Tony said, a lot of players don't really view this as cheating in the same way that they do steroids. It's as if, for a lot of the players, it's like getting up in the morning and having their cup of coffee.
Tony Gwynn, of course, didn't go public until after he had retired. This is the pattern that we had discussed before. Will it take a player who's still employed to really get some action?
That's a big key, because the reaction to Tony after the story came out was basically, well, he's a retired player, and it's, you know, it's not right for him to come out and say something. And there was a lot of knocking of the messenger rather than looking at the message itself. And I, you know, I wonder if it's going to take someone actually dropping dead on a field someday. Quite frankly, where, you know, you have a star player in his late 30s come forward and say, this has been a real problem for me, in the same way that happened with Lyle Alzado in the NFL,
mm-hmm.
where, it, you know, on, basically on his deathbed, he came out and said, look, I took all this stuff and look what it did to me.
Buster Olney is a reporter for The New York Times. Buster, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for calling.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. At the Greyhound Pub in Tinsley Green, West Sussex, the reigning champion Saxonia Globe Snipers of Germany retained their World Marbles Championship. Temperance, or at least relative temperance, was the German side's advantage, according to championship spokeswoman Julia McCarthy Fox. The British players lost their marbles altogether, Ms. Fox reported. It was too much alcohol. If you put a lot of men in a pub environment and there is beer or marbles, what are they going to choose? They're going to choose the beer. Demonstrating more discipline than her countrymen, Jen McGowan of Middleton-on-Sea, West Sussex, won the Ladies' Cup.
Tequila polka. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The rapid emergence of Shiite religious leaders as major contenders for power in Iraq is causing new divisions within the Bush administration. You can read more about the story at WBUR.org. And join us at 10 this morning for a rebroadcast of the Final Connection program from Baghdad with Dick Gordon. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. Crescent Ridge Dairy, the dairy that delivers, offering home delivery of farm-fresh milk in glass bottles, now available at Bread and Circus Whole Foods Market and on the web at crescentridge.com. And ThoughtForm's Green Building Division, emphasizing environmentally sensitive and sustainable construction, located in Acton and on the web at thoughtforms-corp.com. Showers in the forecast today, heavy rain at times this afternoon, highs in the upper 40s. In Boston now it is 46 degrees and it's 46 in Hyannis. It's 7:20. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, presidents who've exercised their executive prerogative to overrule the laws of golf. But first... The Fed Cup, the women's version of the more celebrated Davis Cup competition, has not traditionally drawn enormous interest, but you wouldn't know that from the screaming, chanting, delirious crowd of more than 1,000 children who showed up at the Reggie Lewis Center in Boston on Wednesday to greet the current Fed Cup players. Team captain Billie Jean King knew precisely why the event drew a multitude.
Serena and Venus have truly transcended tennis and... Everybody knows who they are. They're household names. And when they come to an event, it sold out. They definitely have made the difference.
The same can be said of the actual Fed Cup competition, which will pit the U.S. team against a team from the Czech Republic in Lowell, Massachusetts, beginning today. Tickets to the event sold out within a few hours, the fastest sellout in Fed Cup history. The Williams sisters are joined on this year's team by Alexandra Stevenson and Megan Shaughnessy, which means, as Captain King pointed out, that the complexion of the game has literally changed.
For the first time, we have three teammates of color. We've never had that. We've only had up to two with Serena and Venus. We also have our assistant coach, Gina Garrison, as a person of color. I think this is unbelievable for our sport of tennis. When I grew up in tennis, it was a very elitist sport. I think that's been changing over the last few years.
Is it maybe a sign of progress that it hasn't been a big deal? Nobody's written all that many stories about
the race. It's a big deal to me, though, because I'm old.
But you know what I'm saying.
I've seen progress, and it is a big deal that they have not made it a big deal. Yes, absolutely. People are starting to realize that it's the way it should be.
Alexandra Stevenson, who has ranked as high as 18th in the world, agreed.
There really hasn't been a big deal about it because we're all Americans, and it's wonderful that it's a multicultural team, and I think that's good. There's still progress to be made around the world and in the United States, but it's really nice that we're all here, and I think it's the first time there's been three of us on the Fed Cup team all at once.
Well, sure, who could argue with that? But after some of the children on hand had enjoyed the opportunity to hit tennis balls with the pros and also ask the players questions, I couldn't help posing a question of my own to the minority member of the Fed Cup team, Megan Shaughnessy.
I can't help asking, and I hope you won't take this the wrong way, but if any of these kids said to you, how did a white kid get on this team?
Yeah, I'm sure that's gone through their mind. That's a funny question.
Despite progress on one front, Fed Cup captain Billie Jean King, who's perhaps as famous now for championing the rights of female athletes at all levels as she is for all her Wimbledon titles, never lets slide an opportunity to remind folks, even child-sized folks, that there are still battles to be fought. Addressing the crowd before the actual tennis began, she chided the sports media.
But just so you know, in the sports page, women get 8.7% of the sports page. So we have a long way to go. In fact, horses and dogs get another 8%. So we're about equal with the horses and the dogs. And the rest goes to men's sports. So we have a long way to go, but things like Fed Cup and you participating and believing in yourself, and both men and women working together and helping each other so we all have equality for all people.
The undeniable educational, cultural, and entertainment value of Wednesday's event notwithstanding, the fact that the Fed Cup players are in Massachusetts to play an actual tennis match was not entirely forgotten. When it was Serena Williams' turn to address the press and the future tennis champions, she reminded them of the unpredictable nature of competition.
You know, people usually say, oh, the Williamses, or, you know, the whole team, Alexandra Stevenson, Megan Shaughnessy, will definitely be able to beat them. But that's definitely not, we don't want to take it so easy. We're definitely looking forward to it being a tough game because the Czech definitely is really good players.
Yeah, whatever was written all over the faces of the interrogators at that point. And one of them, who stood about 5'1", got in the next, more compelling question, which Venus handled.
What does it feel like to compete against your sister?
Well, she's great, but she's, you know, real tough. And she's, you know, the number one player in the world now. And she deserves it. She sure does. And all I have to do is now look at her and try to do what she's doing.
Venus Williams, still wearing a microphone, also had the opportunity to do more than just talk about competitive tennis. Racket in hand, she instructed a group of youngsters, one at a time, in the art of the serve and volley. Some of that determination and confidence may have rubbed off on at least a few of the children at Wednesday's event. Andrea Bug and some of her friends from the Wellesley Middle School were among those lucky enough to volley against the champs.
We're here with Serena.
Was she taking it easy on you?
Yeah. I don't think so.
No?
No, because since I'm a professional and I'm the best, so.
Oh, good.
You wish.
When Fed Cup play begins this afternoon, Venus Williams, ranked number 2 in the world, will face Daya Bedinova, who is ranked 44th. In the second singles match, Serena Williams, ranked number 1 in the world, will take on Iveta Benisova, who is ranked 74th. Tomorrow, the Williams sisters will switch opponents, and they will also team up in the doubles competition. Yesterday, the WNBA and its Players Association finally agreed that they did have an agreement. The players managed to get the minimum salary raised from $40,000 to $42,000, and players with 6 years of service have become restricted free agents. Beginning next season, veterans of 6 seasons can become unrestricted free agents. They'll be free to sign with any team. In the previously postponed WNBA draft held yesterday afternoon, LaToya Thomas of Mississippi State was the first player chosen. She'll suit up for the Cleveland Rockers. Sacramento, selecting at number 2, chose 6'6" center Chantel Anderson of Vanderbilt, and Detroit made Louisiana Tech's Cheryl Ford the 3rd overall pick. Calvin Coolidge was hopeless at it. Gerald Ford was pretty fair, albeit erratic. Richard Nixon cheated at it, but not as creatively as Bill Clinton did. The activity that those presidents and several others shared is golf. In a new book, First Off the Tee, Don Van Natta has chronicled the adventures of 14 golfing presidents. He joins me now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Don, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be here.
You have a background as an investigative reporter. What led you to want to investigate the matter of how well various presidents play or have played golf?
Well, you know, presidents don't invite reporters around the links with them. And reporters are allowed to watch them tee off, and then they don't see them again until the 18th green. And it just intrigued me to find out how these presidents, these 14 golfing presidents, conducted themselves on the links. I mean, it's the old saw that golf is a prism into a man's character, and it turns out to be absolutely true. Golf is a metaphor for many of these presidents' personalities and their time in office.
My absolute favorite comment from a president about golf actually comes from Ulysses Grant. Having very briefly tried the game, he allegedly said, quote, "I fail to see what use there is for a ball." Were you able to confirm that line?
Yes, that's precisely what he said. In 1877, Ulysses S. Grant was the first president to actually attempt to play. Mm-hmm. And I say attempt to play because he swung and missed for about 5 minutes. And threw down the club and said exactly what you said. I don't know, you know, why there's a ball here. It's good exercise for the arms. And he never played again.
Now, is there any indication that he perhaps visited the 19th hole before he visited the first tee?
That's probably a good guess, Bill. Probably so.
You report that John Kennedy was the president most accomplished at golf, but he tried to keep his prowess and his enjoyment of the game a secret, I gather.
He did. He was concerned about being confused with the duffer-in-chief whom he replaced, and that, of course, was Dwight Eisenhower. Kennedy and the Democrats made a lot of Eisenhower's love of the game, and they portrayed his love as a symbol of him being sort of an old relic from a different time. And so John F. Kennedy kept his game in the closet really until about 3 months after he became president. And he only let his love of the game out gradually and never completely, and only because there were rumors that on those afternoons that he disappeared from the White House, he may have been participating in other extracurricular activities. So golf was a way to deny those rumors. And so Pierre Salinger finally acknowledged it in April of 1961 that Kennedy was not just a golfer, but a pretty good one.
Among the presidents who cheated at golf are Richard Nixon, Warren Harding, Lyndon Johnson, and Bill Clinton. But we shouldn't be surprised, right? You found a survey that indicates that almost all wealthy, well-connected corporate types cheat at golf.
That's right. I found a survey last summer by Starwood Hotels that found that 82% of chief executive officers in America actually cheat at golf. But the funny part about the survey is that it also found that 82% of the people that were surveyed don't like golf cheaters. So So it's that old businessman saw, you know, I'm going to do it to you before you do it to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and the survey also found that CEOs felt if they turned the other cheek when somebody cheated at golf and if it would help them strike a business deal, they would do it then.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a means to striking business deals at times, too.
President Clinton's method of creative rule interpretation is unusual enough so that he earned a name. A mulligan, as most golfers know, is a free shot, kind of a takeover. But how does a billigan differ from that?
Yes, a billigan is Clinton's own invention. The term is my invention. But what Bill Clinton does, he takes do-over shots in a sort of more subtle, more devious way, actually. What he does is he takes a tee shot. If he doesn't like it, he takes a second one and then even a third one. Now, he calls those practice shots. But then we've got three golf balls out on the fairway, and the president gets out there and he asks his playing partners, now, which one was my first one? Because he's trying to make a good show for me that he plays by the rules.
Mm-hmm.
But inevitably, his playing partners become sort of co-conspirators, and they say, well, Mr. President, it's this ball over here, the one closest to the flag. And more often than not, that was his second or third one. So he'd say, okay, I'll play that one. Then he'd take three shots off the fairway, and you'd have three balls laying around the green, and the same thing would happen again. And it happened over and over again during my round that I played with him last August at the golf club of Purchase, just down the road from his house in Chappaqua. And at the end of the 18 holes, it turned out he took about 200 swings to card in 82. Pretty remarkable. And so at the end of the day, I thought Billigan's is really what this is. I don't think any other president played quite this way.
George W. Bush rates mention as a cheater as well. At one point, you heard him swear that he upholds the rules, and then you saw him hit three drives off the first tee, after which I presume that he played the best of the three.
Yes, he did. His father, you know, President Bush, the elder President Bush, gave me an interview for this book, and he insisted that the Bushes play by the rules. But more than once, George W. Bush has also indulged in mulligan taking, like most weekend hackers do. My favorite George W. Bush story, though, was last summer when one morning very early in Kennebunkport, he showed up on the first tee, and the night before there had been a suicide bombing in Israel where nine people were killed, a very serious matter.
Mm-hmm.
And George W. Bush announced that he was very upset about what had happened overnight, and he demanded that all the nations of the world do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers. And then without missing a beat, he said, thank you. Now watch this drive. And it was a pretty remarkable moment. It was George W. Bush demanding that the nations of the world do what they can to stop terrorism, and then he quickly turned his attention, while the nations of the world were doing that, to his golf game.
You alluded to the fact that character is revealed on the golf course. Of which of the presidents does that seem to you to be especially true?
Well, Lyndon Baines Johnson comes to mind immediately. LBJ qualified for my Hail to the Cheats foursome. And I call him President Mulligan because he took 300 to 400 shots. But unlike Bill Clinton and Richard Nixon, he didn't take the do-over shots because he was trying to lower his score to impress everybody. He just wanted the feel of one perfect golf shot. And if it was going to take 400 swings to do it, then LBJ was the kind of guy that, you know, damn it, nobody get in his way. He was going to do it. But LBJ had to be persuaded to play because politics mattered most of all to LBJ, and nothing was really second. Yet Jack Valenti, his aide, persuaded LBJ to play golf because he said, you know, there's a lot of senators up on the Hill who play golf and would love to play with you. And you can, rather than, while you're playing out there, you can actually lobby these guys to pass legislation that you want passed on the Hill. And that's why he played. And, you know, anybody who played with them was always disappointed because rather than really talking about golf and getting their minds away from business, it was all business with LBJ.
You conclude that the public's attitude toward the game of golf and whether presidents should play it has changed over the years. How is that?
Well, I think that it's changed only really recently. I mean, for many years, presidents were afraid to be seen as golfers. You know, Theodore Roosevelt said golf is fatal. And he said that to his protege, William Howard Taft, who weighed in at 350 pounds, and the entire nation was laughing hysterically at the photographs of Taft squatting heavily with this tiny stick in his hand trying to hit a golf ball. But that advice that golf is fatal really echoed down through the years at the White House, down the corridors of the West Wing, and many presidents sort of heeded that and worried about it. John F. Kennedy refused to have photographers follow him around on the golf course, as did Dwight Eisenhower. Even Richard Nixon forbid photographers from taking his picture on the golf course. It was only during Bill Clinton's two terms in office that attitudes towards golfing presidents changed. And I attribute a lot of that to Tiger Woods. I believe that he really has opened up the game, and millions more Americans are playing it now. There's so many more public golf courses in the country now than there were just 20 years ago. And so it's not so much perceived to be politically fatal by presidential aides as it was all through the years.
Don Van Natta, Jr. is the author of First Off the Tee, published by Public Affairs Press. Don, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much, Bill. Had a great time.
I fixed my eye on the ball, caddy, and swung with genuine swing. But still I've hit nothing at all, caddy. I've simply missed everything. And if in the course of the game, caddy, I make a wrong remark, I'm not in the least to blame, caddy. I must get round there, dark.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Century 21 Real Estate, featuring 165 full-service brokerage offices throughout Massachusetts, and on the web at century21.com/MA. Russell's, in Wayland since 1876, dedicated to organic gardening and preserving the environment. Russell's Garden Center, Route 20 in Wayland. And Graham Contracting, an employee-owned design-build firm specializing in residential renovation. GrahamContracting.com. Good morning, I'm Bob C. in Boston, and in sports, the Boston Red Sox broke a two-game losing streak last night, defeating the Anaheim Angels by a score of 5-2. Casey Fossum pitched seven scoreless innings in the victory, and Shea Hillenbrand went 2-for-4 with a home run. The Boston Celtics have the day off today. Tomorrow, they'll resume their first-round playoff series with the Indiana Pacers at the Fleet Center. The Celtics lead the series by 2-1. And the New England Patriots will try to build for the future in today's NFL draft. The Patriots have the 14th and 19th picks in the first round of the draft. Join us for an exploration of the lush landscape and fascinating culture of Ireland on our next Citizens of the World tour this summer. To learn more, log on to WBUR.org or call 1-800-909-9287. The weather forecast, showers today, heavy at times this afternoon, breezy, highs in the upper 40s, more showers tonight, becoming mostly sunny on Sunday, highs in the 60s, in Boston now it's 46 degrees.
What makes your mom special to you?
Mama, I never let my mom know how much I appreciate her home cooking, but I do after going to school. I love you.
Send your mom a message of love this Mother's Day and support the news by ordering a half pound of Dan's Handmade Chocolates or a beautiful bouquet of spring flowers from WBUR. Make your contribution today online at WBUR.org or call 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, R-rated ratings for pro football prospects. But first, Charlie Pierce, our analyst, joins me on the telephone for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
You ready for some good hockey talk?
Quack, quack.
It took those Mighty Ducks five overtimes to beat the Dallas Stars on Thursday night. Is it time to start asking who can stop the Ducks?
Well, I'm telling you, we made the John Sebastian jokes last week, but he's still playing very, very well. I have to confess they lost me after the third overtime. At one point, I did not care exactly who won that game.
People trying to prop their eyes open to watch the end.
I'm telling you, I'm still more fascinated by the two mystery guests, which are the brand new Minnesota Wild and the actually, literally, completely bankrupt Ottawa Senators.
Before the NBA playoffs began, all the pundits said nobody could guard Shaq. The Lakers are now down 2-1 to the Timberwolves. Has Minnesota, in fact, found a way to nullify the mighty Aristotle?
Well, they found a way to handle a big Aristotle for a couple of games. Let's see what they do when he gets really upset. This is a huge game for the Lakers, the next game, because they do not want to have to go back to Minnesota down a game. Kevin Garnett has raised his level of play remarkably. The supporting cast of the Minnesota Timberwolves, who simply were not there in the first game, have stepped up again. And the Lakers are starting to have one of those periods, as they've had periodically this year, where they look really old.
If the Lakers don't get out of this series with the Timberwolves, does every sports writer in the country start jumping up and down saying, see, you can't just turn it on in the playoffs?
Well, probably, but they're wrong because a lot of teams did it. I mean, most conspicuously, the vintage Boston Celtics did that.
Mm-hmm. What else in this spring's Battle of the Big Kids has caught your attention, Charlie?
Well, I think that the Eastern Conference is a bit more of a jumble, but a little bit more of an entertaining jumble than I thought it was going to be. Indiana, I mean, Detroit is out early. We've had the ascendance of Tracy McGrady, and we've had Indiana playing like an injured, kind of frightened ball club. And within all of that, you've had the absolute transcendent emergence of Allen Iverson as a playoff player.
Mm-hmm.
So while all the talent and certainly I think the better more artistic games are in the West, there are more intriguing stories in the East than I thought there would be.
Happily, there will be a WNBA season after all. My read on this is that the players got clobbered in the alleged negotiations, but they got at least some free agency somewhere down the line.
I think considering they had absolutely no chance of getting anything much more than they did fine. I mean, if all you can get is this, then take it. I do believe they tried their hand and overplayed it a little bit, but the draft goes on and the league goes on.
Tony Gwynn, late of the Padres, said this week that 50% of Major League Baseball's position players use amphetamines, and Tom Glavine, the National League's player representative, said that Tony Gwynn was full of beans. What do you think?
Amphetamines, which have been the drug of choice for Major League Baseball for a sufficiently long time that it began when it was actually legal to take them. They've sort of been buried in the great furor over cocaine in the 70s and 80s and later over performance-enhancing drugs and steroids and ephedra and everything else. They are still epidemic. I don't know that Tony Gwynn's numbers are correct. But if you'll recall, one of the great revelations in Jim Bouton's Ball 4 was the revelation of people taking greenies.
The greenies, that's
and
right.
And the great story about the player who got the pitcher that got lifted after giving up 8 runs in the first inning and sat in the locker room, and Bouton said, "What's wrong?" He said, "My greenie just kicked in."
Elsewhere, I probably shouldn't laugh at that sort of thing, but there you are.
It was okay once to laugh at that sort of thing, you may recall.
Elsewhere on the drug front, former PGA and British Open champion Nick Price contended this week that if the courses keep getting longer, golfers will soon be resorting to steroids. I wonder how that would affect their touch around the greenies. I mean, the greens.
Well, I mean, if people don't understand yet that the game is not worth the candle, particularly golfers who can make a pretty comfortable living without winning tournaments, then I don't know what we have to do to convince them.
Concern about severe acute respiratory syndrome, also known as SARS, has caused some baseball players to wish to avoid Toronto. Charlie, Anaheim Angels pitcher Kevin Apier would rather have the Jays come to Anaheim than vice versa next week. So far, I gather that Major League Baseball is not convinced.
Major League Baseball is not convinced. The owners are not convincing. Players are not convinced. And frankly, the union's not convinced. And frankly, I'm not convinced. As long as Kevin Apier wasn't planning to visit a hospital and wash his hands at regular intervals, he doesn't have a lot to concern about. We are in the middle of one of our periodic running around in the circle, ripping our hair out over something problems. And I think everyone should just settle down a little bit.
The reign of Commissioner Bud Selig is apparently going to come to a close in 2006. Since stepping into the job in 1992, Selig has taken a great deal of heat from all sides, including the one you're presently listening to. How will a commissioner free of Bud Selig's baggage be able to improve circumstances for all those concerned?
Well, it's very likely that the biggest baggage that he will not have is he will not be another owner. Which has always been the real problem with Bud Selig. He will be a puppet. He will be a tool. They're not looking for independent thinking in here any more than the Politburo in China is. But it will be an interesting window into which side in the particular within the various factions of baseball management has the upper hand as to whose candidate gets picked.
It might be reasonable to assume, Charlie, that at age 44, Rickey Henderson would be through with baseball, but not so. He's attempting a comeback. Doesn't he understand that you can't get into the Hall of Fame until you've been retired from the major leagues for five years?
Well, it's another record he wants, I think. I think he wants to be the only active player inducted. You know, this is a guy that thinks he can still contribute and still thinks he probably can run the bases better than most players in the majors right now. You know, if he wants to do it, God love him.
Fan violence in Oakland, Charlie, this week. Carl Everett, a player who's no stranger to bizarre controversy, took a cell phone to the back of the head, and the guy who threw the phone was arrested on suspicion of assault with a deadly weapon. Good call?
Well, I mean, I think myself there are certain circumstances under which you would throw things at people who have cell phones. but I think they're overcharging him a little bit. Drunk and disorderly is probably what he's looking for here.
It's NFL draft weekend. We've gone all this time without mentioning it. Good on us, I say. But is there anything you'd like to mention in this context?
No, I think the most intriguing player is Byron Leftwich, the quarterback from Marshall, whom everybody would like to draft and whom everybody is too much of a coward to try on. I think he's going to be a terrific player in the NFL. I think he's going to be better than Carson Palmer, who's already signed with the woeful Cincinnati Bengals, who will continue to be woeful whether Carson's there or not.
On Wednesday, Mario Andretti became the oldest man to drive 226 miles an hour legally. The story had a happy ending for Andretti, though not, I gather, for the car that he was in.
No, he went airborne at 200 miles an hour and turned over and came out of it with a bruised ankle or something like that. Now, I would think that he is on such close terms with his own mortality and has been for almost half a century now that ought to be enough.
Finally, Charlie, a pair of British mountain climbers have set a record for high-altitude ironing. While at 17,800 feet up Mount Everest, they pressed a flag. And I suppose they could say they climbed the mountain because it was there, but I can't believe the ironing board was there.
I think it's really going to be terrible if like the summit of Mount Everest turns into Walmart. I mean, all this tourist stuff. I keep waiting, you know, to see the guy making the final ascent and you know, walk by like a curio shop or something.
Charlie Pierce, never wrinkled, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He also joins me each week here at Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
The National Football League's draft occurs today and tomorrow, which means each team's meat merchants have been poring over those most curious documents, the scouting reports on the class of 03. It may break Terrence Newman's heart, not to mention diminish the size of his signing bonus, but the pre-draft word on the 5'10", 180-pound cornerback out of Kansas State is that he, quote, shows an inconsistent pad level. It hardly seems fair to blame Terrence Newman for something the equipment manager should have remedied, but never mind that. A few lines earlier in his scouting report, Newman is praised for his ability to track, reach, and pluck. Perhaps these qualities will compensate for his suspect pad level. Dwayne Robinson, the defensive tackle from Kentucky, may also be sweating this draft. His stats are fine, 114 tackles and 26 stops behind the line in three seasons for the Wildcats. But whoever wrote his scouting report noticed that, quote, Dwayne's size could be a problem in the two-gap system, and that, quote, he can get reckless while operating in space. Now, Dwayne weighs 317 pounds, so it could be argued from a medical point of view that his size may indeed be a problem, especially down the line. But the comment in the scouting report suggests that he's actually too small to fill the role envisioned for him. Lordy. As far as his recklessness while operating in space is concerned, perhaps he should forego the option of post-football employment with NASA. What else can that curious criticism mean? Terrell Suggs, the 6'3", 262-pound defensive end from Arizona State, will no doubt be delighted to learn that the scouts admire his, quote, hip swerve. Larry Johnson of Penn State also has above-average hip swerve, and though he lacks, quote, lateral bounce, he does run with, quote, good body lean. Marcus Trufant, the cornerback from Washington State, has, quote, quick twitch movements going for him, though whoever wrote that report felt that young Marcus sometimes looked, quote, too casual in his movements. So either he should slow down some of those quick twitches or stop wearing such baggy trousers and turning his helmet backwards. Perhaps the most curious, not to say provocative, scouting report celebrates Michigan State wide receiver Charles Rogers, who impressed the author of the report not only with his hip swerve and, quote, wiggle, but with his, quote, tight skin and tight bubble. The latter no doubt means precisely what you would guess it means, which suggests that somebody probably ought to remind the scout responsible for that assessment that Mr. Rogers is auditioning for the National Football League and not for the Chippendale Dancers. In what appears to be a case of life imitating art, TV cartoon art to be precise, the new AAA baseball team in Albuquerque, New Mexico, has stolen its name from the minor league team in the Springfield occupied by noted nuclear power plant employee Homer Simpson and his nuclear family. The Simpsons support the Springfield Isotopes, a team Homer helped keep in Springfield by going on a hunger strike a couple of years ago. So how can the Isotopes be in New Mexico as well? Paul Ingles explains from Isotopes Park in Albuquerque.
They're secretly planning to move to Albuquerque.
That's crazy. It would have been on a talk radio show like Sports Chat or Sportzilla and the Jabberjocks.
Yeah!
Nobody in Springfield believed Homer Simpson when he stumbled onto secret plans to move the Isotopes to Albuquerque. Woozy after 8 days of his hunger strike, even Homer forgot why he was fasting until team owners offered him a new hot dog with Southwest relish on it at the ballpark.
It's the kind of bold flavor they enjoy in Albuquerque!
He's right!
Yeah, and the rapper says Albuquerque Isotopes!
Although Simpsons producers say they didn't know it, back in the real world, Albuquerque was in fact looking for a minor league baseball team, facing its first spring without the Albuquerque Dukes. The AAA Dodger franchise had moved to Portland for the 2001 season after Albuquerque city officials balked on paying for much-needed improvements to the 31-year-old Duke Stadium. But the city had already changed its tune by the time that Simpsons episode aired. Negotiations to bring the Calgary Cannons to Albuquerque were underway, and a bond vote for a new stadium was scheduled. By spring 2002, the deal was done. And when it came to a team nickname, Isotopes started showing up in fan polls, neck and neck with the traditional Dukes. The debate raged on local sports talk shows for months.
Bill on a cell phone, you're next. What do you think, Bill?
At first I was against Isotopes, but you know, I've really warmed up to the idea. I think that it could actually turn into nationwide marketing opportunities, and I think that's great.
Still, there was considerable support for the Dukes name. Albuquerque's known as the Duke City, named after Spain's Duke of Albuquerque. And Dukes had been used by city baseball teams since 1915. In the Simpsons Springfield, Isotopes connected with the town's nuclear power plant. Here, it connected with the state's two national nuclear science labs. After milking the free publicity for months, the club made it official last September. New team, new stadium, new name.
And now, it's time for the introduction of your new home team. Your 2003
On opening day, over 12,000 packed into the sparkling new Isotopes Park, built on the foundation of the old Duke Stadium, and team owners pulled out all the stops.
Here come the F-16s!
There was a formation flyover from nearby Kirtland Air Force Base, pre- and post-game fireworks, free Isotopes baseballs for the first 5,000, and larger-than-life Bart and Homer Simpson characters roaming the stands.
Homer!
Bart!
At the park souvenir shop, Jeff Patrick, the team's merchandising director, was frantically restocking as shirts and caps flew off the shelves.
Okay, do you have somebody that can stock them if I bring them now,
yeah,
or do you want to wait?
Yeah, we can bring them in right now.
It's this kind of excitement over Isotopes merchandise that lured Patrick to Albuquerque from a similar job with the Omaha Royals.
What we did at Christmas was more than I did in Omaha in a year. So it's definitely been very well received nationwide. As well as at home. I mean, the hometown fans, as you can see, you know, look around and just everybody's got something on.
The fans have taken to the new logo, an atomic symbol with a baseball flying around it. But there are more than a few who don't quite know what an isotope actually is.
Isn't it like the
the metal part. Is it metal? Well, I thought it was
it's
like...
It's a confusing subject, actually. I think it might be something doing having to do with outer space. Don't know.
It's a...
Nuclear it's something.
It's a molecule of a nuclear bomb, basically.
I believe it's an element within an atom. Something along those lines.
It has something to do with radiochemistry or something, but it's a baseball player as far as I'm concerned.
Topes are the coolest! Topes, topes, topes!
Dukes, Dukes, Dukes!
Larry Rose, one of a very few to trot out old Albuquerque Dukes paraphernalia for the night, pointed to his Dukes t-shirt.
See, I'm showing that the Dukes won 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 PCL championships. So I was trying to give the Isotopes some inspiration.
While some fans are still giddy over how this Isotopes team came to pass, there was one fella at the game whose t-shirt read, "The Isotope is a blah, blah, blah. It came from an episode of the blah, blah, blah. Just play ball." For Only a Game, I'm Paul Ingles in Albuquerque.
In the Isotope second, 2 runs, 2 hits, 1 red on the earth.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Mike Garth. Our senior producer is Gary Wallace. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, see photos of the Fed Cup team, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. In our final word this week, Venus Williams delights young and old with her advice for tennis players.
Work hard, have fun, and listen to those older than you, and then have some more fun.
Easy enough for a tennis player, I suppose, as long as she's not facing a Williams across the net. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is W...
National Public Radio.
This is W...